Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon on Faith Radio. And there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Good day to you. Thanks so much for tuning in. We've got a great program ahead this hour. We've had a great week and looking forward to today's conversation as well. I'm Neil Stavem. Ted Ross at the controls. Ted, did you ever serve on jury duty?
I've never been called. Okay. Not yet. All right. It's probably coming.
We get to be on the jury today.
All right, get my chance.
We're going to talk with a former atheist, a seasoned cold case detective, and popular national speaker. He's going to tackle his most important case, and we get to be on the jury.
So, excellent.
Are you ready?
This will be fun.
Yes. We've got some copies of his book to go his way as well. And you know, when we have resources, we always love to be able to pass them on to you and hope that they're useful for you. You can read them, maybe pass them on to a friend or just encourage someone in their faith, and that'll be the case today as we talk God's Crime Scene. A cold case detective examines the evidence for a divinely created universe. And let me introduce our guest today, J. Warner Wallace, cold case homicide detective. He's served in law enforcement for 25-plus years. He's adjunct professor of apologetics at Biola University, Christian casemaker and author. He was a conscientious and vocal atheist through his undergraduate and graduate work. Also considered himself to be an evidentialist. His experience in law enforcement only served to strengthen his conviction that truth is tied directly to evidence. But we're going to find out about his conversion experience and coming to follow Christ. And since then, he has earned a master's degree in theological studies from Golden Gate Baptist Theological Seminary. His first book, Cold Case Christianity, provides readers with principles of cold case investigation. I think you've had him on back when you were in the morning show.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so, great conversation with him.
Looking forward to welcoming back J. Warner Wallace to Faith Radio. Jay, thanks so much for coming on with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's always fun to talk to you guys.
This is a interesting book and an interesting topic, and it's one that you know, we probably wouldn't think of right away when we think about detective work. But obviously, there is some evidence that needs to be examined. Maybe just say a little bit about. I know as you kind of introduced the book, you know, which is full of great stories, by the way. And I guess we should probably say they're sort of real situations, but not real names and not too detailed. But I mean, you were a homicide detective, so these are situations that were generally murder, right?
Yeah, and it turns out that there are some things you learn working any kind of investigation, and in particular cold cases and homicides, that you can turn around and use toward other things. You know, the first book I did was really about looking at whether we think something is a reliable eyewitness. I mean, how do we judge eyewitnesses, and how do we evaluate them, and could we use some of those principles to evaluate the authors of the Gospels? And I think you can, and this is what I tried to show in Cold Case Christianity. Here, what I'm doing is taking a different approach. You know, sometimes you have a case where you're looking top down. It's, you know, the suspect, you're really evaluating the suspect, the things he's said, he's been a known suspect for years. Well, and other times you're working bottom up, where you have no idea who the suspect is, but you do have a crime scene. So in top down cases, you're really looking at a skill set which involves evaluating witnesses and people. When you're doing bottom up investigations, you're looking at a skill set that really evaluates how well you can assess a crime scene. So what we're doing with the second book is looking at the universe and using a principle we use at every death scene to determine if it's a crime scene, because there are four ways to die, and not all of them are criminal. You can die by way of accident, natural causes, suicide. Those are not going to involve a homicide investigation. But if you die in the fourth way, murder, we have to get involved. And so how do we determine when you walk in the room and you've got a dead body? How do you determine which of those four it is? And it's a simple process, guys. What you do is you ask this question: can I explain everything in the room by staying in the room. If I can, it's probably not a murder. So if I've got a dead body and a gunshot wound, and I've got a pistol laying next to the body, but it's his pistol, it's been in the room for, you know, years, he's owned this thing, and it's got his fingerprints on it, and there's a suicide note, everything's locked up tight, and there's no sign of anybody else being in the room with him, well, that's going to be something other than a homicide. It's probably going to be a suicide or an accident. But again, on the other hand, if it's not his pistol, And there's evidence in the room that doesn't come back to him, and there's even bloody footprints leading out of the room. Well, now I've got to go outside the room to explain the stuff that I have inside the room. Everything shifts. We've now got evidence of an intruder, and intruders are what turn really death scenes into crime scenes, so everything shifts. And so what I said was, well, can we look at the universe with the same principle? There's 8 pieces of evidence that I think everyone has to explain in the universe. The only question is, can I stay inside the room of the universe to get the answer? If I can't get the cause of these 8 things by staying inside the room, if I have to go outside the natural realm of the universe for an answer, well, then I've got good reason to suspect I've got some kind of an intruder. Of course, at this level, though, who and what could that intruder be? And so this is why we call this book God's Crime Scene, not because we're suggesting that God has done a crime, but because we think we can look at the universe as a crime scene and use these simple principles. And so, yeah, you're right. Every chapter starts off with some kind of a crime scene, but we're going to talk about a principle we use to solve it, and then we're going to turn a corner and apply that principle to the universe.
Because those that believe that God wasn't involved in the universe beginning, of course, are all they're inside the room, but it's all natural causes, right?
That's right. If you stay inside the room, you can get all the explanations by staying inside the room. Then some form of naturalism involving the stuff of nature, space, time, matter, the laws of physics and chemistry that govern space, time, and matter, that's all you can use because you're staying inside the room. And if your naturalism is correct, you should be able to get all 8 of these things with just those causes and factors. And the question, of course, can you get, you know, the universe itself from those things? Can you get the appearance of fine-tuning for life? Can you get the origin of life in the universe from just those things? Can you get the appearance of design in biology from those things? Can you get consciousness and free agency and objective transcendent moral truths and even the issue of evil? Can we really get what we believe is a transcendent objective evil if all we have is the forces of nature and space, time, and matter? So we have to look at those issues, and I think the best explanation really is outside the room.
We'll unpack those as we go along a little bit today as we talk with J. Warren Wallace. And Jim Wallace has written this amazing new book called God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Detective Examines the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe. And Jim, just as a detective, I know that you make a case file whenever you're working on an investigation. You know, if we're building a case file for creation, maybe what would it include? Or, I mean, what should we start with before we maybe go any further?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, some people will say sometimes you just don't know if you can make this kind of a case for God's existence, and are we really just deferring to the fact we cannot explain these 8 things from natural causes? But I think those 8 things are in your case. I think when we build a case with the suspect, we typically build it circumstantially. We use circumstantial evidence. I talk about that in the first book. This is a very valid form of evidence. The vast majority of cases around America are tried on nothing more than circumstantial evidence. And when you do those kinds of cases, you build them robustly from a number of different kinds of evidence in a number of different categories. So let's say, for example, I was looking at you as a suspect, and I just had one witness who said, well, I saw him at the scene of the crime. That might be good. But if I can destroy that one witness, if I can attack that witness's credibility on the stand, the whole case goes away and crumbles because it's built on one piece of evidence, direct evidence with eyewitness testimony. But that's it. On the other hand, if I had witnesses, more than one witness seeing you do it, if I had you saying things before and after the crime that implicate you doing things before and have certain behaviors, if I had some physical evidence at the scene, in other words, if I had 4 or 5 different categories of evidence and 2 or 3 lines of evidence from each category, all pointing to you as my suspect, then I've got a good reason to believe you're my guy. Well, it turns out we have these 8 pieces of evidence in 4 very different categories: cosmological evidence, biological evidence, mental evidence, moral evidence, and all of these just happen to point to the same external suspect. And when that happens, you can have good confidence that you've built a case that'll stand up in court.
Talking about God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Detective Examines the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe. Is there a question, a key question that we need to ask first, or is it? Have we ever talked about that? Is it the inside of the room, the outside of the room, or is there something else foundational?
I think that's the approach. That's the approach we probably would take here. But one more thing we got to do before we even begin an investigation like this is remember, we have to come into every investigation without presupposing which category the answer is going to come from. If I walk into a murder scene and I presuppose, well, you know, this is going to be a male or this is going to be a female, I can get surprised. I mean, there are times when you might think it's going to be in one category, but if you don't open your mind to all the possibilities and wherever the evidence may lead, you end up in the wrong place because you started off in the wrong place and you refuse to budge. So we're going to look at this issue, right, of inside the room or outside the room. But if you've already determined, I refuse to go outside the room no matter what because I don't believe there's an outside the room to go to, well, then guess what? You're going to find a way to twist all the evidence as awkwardly as you can to look for an internal solution. And so what we did in God's crime scene is look at every single piece of evidence and all the explanations from inside the room as well as outside the room. So I want people to see that, yeah, you can force yourself to find an answer inside the room, but those answers don't work. I mean, they're ridiculously insufficient, and so people still cling to them because if they refuse to acknowledge anything supernatural could exist, well, the only thing you've got in the game, the only stuff you have to work with are answers inside the natural realm of the universe, and you will find a way to make those work because you refuse to go outside. So we have to have those two things in play. What's our tactic? What's our approach? And then two, are we allowing ourselves to consider options?
Well, maybe just before we take a break, say a word about your own background and your change of view, because you were a vocal atheist. So did you have presuppositions that said, you know, there's nothing beyond material energy shaped by chance?
Oh, absolutely. I was a committed philosophical naturalist, and I was, you know, part of that generation in the 60s and 70s that would have said, you know, hey, we just put a man on the moon. You know, we're doing all this, you know, 2001 A Space Odyssey. I mean, we're doing all the kinds of movies and Star Trek First Generation, and, you know, all of us thought that eventually, I think, that science would have the answers that we were looking for. And, you know, I thought whatever questions you may have, I always felt like we were closing the gap on our questions. We were closing the mysteries because our scientific discoveries were closing that gap for us. So why would I jump off to belief in a God when we've rejected every other God? And we've learned that, you know, God's not throwing the lightning bolts. We've got science to demonstrate where thunder and lightning come from. We know that God's not causing the rain. You know, we know what the hydrological cycles are. We know how this works physically. So we're removing the mysteries of God and replacing them with the known facts of science. And I would have said that why would I, you know, not continue to do that? Why would I jump to God's? But it turns out that we're actually not closing the gap. The more we learn in these eight areas that I describe in the book, really, the bigger the questions, the deeper the wormhole, the larger the gap to our understanding. So I think that in the end, I was completely wrong about that. And at 35, I started to look at this and challenge my own philosophical naturalism. And that's when I started to think that perhaps I was wrong about my staunch atheism.
Well, if you're maybe relating to Jim Wallace's perspective and say, you know, maybe I would it's time to challenge my own perspective, my own viewpoint. Let me just encourage you to stick around and call and sign up for a copy of the book, God's Crime Scene. We've got a couple of copies to give away. It's a cold case detective examines the evidence for a divinely created universe. We'll find out, you know, does science have all the answers? More on that in just a moment with J. Warner Wallace, cold case homicide detective, adjunct professor and Christian casemaker and author. He's written the best-selling book, Cold Case Christianity. His new one now is God's Crime Scene. Got some copies to give away. Here's the phone number. It's 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. And you sign up for a copy of the book, and you can join us for the conversation as well. We'll get to some of those eight pieces of evidence and more coming up. Is there enough evidence around us to realize that this universe was divinely created? Or is it all internal, a matter of matter, and that science has answered all the questions for us? J. Warner Wallace is a cold case homicide detective. He's been in law enforcement for over 25 years, and he takes an evidence approach to looking at the crime scene, if you will, God's crime scene. That's the title of his new book. We've got some copies to give away. The number is 877-93-FAITH. As we talk about evidence for a divinely created universe. And maybe before we jump into some of those eight pieces of evidence, Jim, you mentioned three things. You talk about origination, causation, and explanation. Maybe we need to just set the stage with that.
Well, I think this is the first thing you do, right, when you look at certain pieces of evidence in a scene. You've got to ask the question, how did they get here? And how they get here and when they have first appeared in the scene is huge, because it helps us to determine if they were, number one, do they matter? I mean, they only matter if the first appearance of this piece of evidence coincides with the appearance of the suspect. If it's something that was in the scene all along, it's just an artifact. It's just something that's part of the scene. If it gets moved in a certain way or deposited, though, at the point of the appearance of the suspect, well, then it has some evidential value for us. So those are three questions that we often ask, the first kind of simple evidential questions we ask when it comes to evidence we see in a scene. It turns out, though, I think we really have to ask those questions about the scene itself if we're going to look at the universe as a crime scene, because the question is, when did this, you know, origination of the evidence, let's back up. We're in a crime scene. How did the crime scene get here? How did the entire universe come into existence? And that's when I think those three questions become critical, because in the end, we're asking the stuff of the universe, space, time, and matter, the laws of physics that govern those things. Is that what causes the universe? Did the universe cause itself, or is the universe itself just eternally old, so it's uncaused? Because if it has no beginning, there's no reason to suspect it needs a cause. Or does it have a beginning? And if it does, what could be sufficient to cause all space, time, and matter to leap into existence from nothing? And you might think, well, wait a minute. Well, space is nothing. No. Space is something. So what is nothing? Nothing is what, Aristotle, it's the stuff that rocks dream about, okay, as philosophers will sometimes refer to. It's nothing. It's space is something, and we're suggesting in the book all the evidence we have scientifically points that to the reality that all space, time, and matter has a beginning. It is not eternally old. And if it isn't eternally old, what is the non-spatial, atemporal, non-material cause that could cause all space, time, and matter to leap into existence from nothing? And that's the thing that we've been talking about and debating about for some time. Some of the staunch atheists that you see publicly doing this work are offering suggestions, and I offer them all in the book. I talk about all the alternatives. How do we avoid and to be honest, right away, even most atheists know they have to step outside of space, time, and matter to explain the existence and origin of space, time, and matter. So in the very first move, we're already outside the room.
Getting a fresh perspective about the world in which we enjoy and experience life every day, and realize that God's design was behind it. We talked about eight pieces of evidence, and we sort of touched on them, and maybe this would be a good time to just sort of lay those out as we kind of come to the crime scene. Summarize those a bit more.
So this first piece of evidence we're talking about is the origin of the universe. So we've got it. Everyone's got to account for how the universe. Now, we, of course, as Christians, we look at Genesis 1 and we have an account of how everything came to existence from nothing at the hand of God. But everyone's got to think about how the universe came into existence. That's the first piece of evidence. Two, there's fine-tuning in this universe for life. It's not just that the universe exists. The parameters, the cosmological, universal kind of constants of our universe are so incredibly fine-tuned that it's the smallest, we're talking about variation that's phenomenally, impossibly small. Any small variation in any one of the universal constants, and everything in the universe shuts down. We don't get a universe like ours. Any small changes in things at the foundational level related to the weak nuclear force, strong nuclear force, electromagnetism, all these things are so finely tuned that the smallest variation, I list all of these in the book, would create a universe that either doesn't exist at all or it exists radically differently and life could not emerge. We're not only in a universe that began, number number two, we're in a universe that is fine-tuned for life. In fact, the third piece of evidence, we've got the origin of life from non-life. How does that even happen? This is something that has been studied now for generations, and we are no closer to having even a reasonable pathway to life from non-life than we were 30 years ago. We're not making any ground scientifically on this question. Four, we also have the appearance, and even Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, would agree that we have the appearance of design in biology. He says that all of biology is a study of the appearance, quote-unquote, of design, even though he would reject the existence of a designer. So we have the appearance of design in biology, certain attributes of design we'll talk about in the book. Those are the first four things. Then we have four more. We have consciousness. We are conscious creatures. And think about what consciousness is. It is the immaterial state of being that we all experience, but we want to explain this. What if we're an atheist? All you have is the material universe, and suddenly we have the emergence of immaterial consciousness? How do we even explain that immaterial consciousness, as one atheist puts it, can emerge from lumpy gray matter with your brain? So we have to talk about that. Then for number six in this list is free agency. We aren't just determined dominoes that are following in a physical sequence, which we would expect if we were in a purely physical material universe. We actually can step out of the cause and effect and make free will choices. This has been a mystery for people who have studied this now forever. It's called the problem of mind and free agency. And then we also have to explain, finally, objective, transcendent moral truths. Most of us recognize these. These are things we realize it's never okay to torture babies for fun, for example. These are objective, transcendent moral principles that all of us recognize. How do we ground those? And finally, if we think there's evil in the world, do we think it's more than just our opinion? Do we think that evil is transcendent? There are some things that are truly, truly transcendently evil. Well, how could that be true? How could that be so if there isn't a transcendent standard of good by which we are measuring anything we would call evil? So these are the eight things that I think all of us have to explain. And I just think the best explanation for these eight things is not inside of the naturalistic universe. In fact, I think scientists have been just beating themselves up trying to figure out how to explain those things. I think, in fact, the best explanation for those is a divine creator that is a free agent, a conscious mind that creates creatively with design principles, because he is a master designer, and he is the standard, the virtuous standard of moral truth by which we judge anything to be morally virtuous, and we even see this standard of goodness as the standard by which we measure anything evil. I think that's the best explanation we have, and it's not in the room, it's outside.
And as you said, some explanations are more reasonable than others. We're going to unpack that a little bit more as we go on the second half of the program and understand, how do we explain? There's always more than one way to explain the evidence, and we'll build the case for God's crime scene. A cold case detective examines the evidence for a divinely created universe. That's the subtitle of J. Warner Wallace's new book. Jim Wallace's book is from David C. Cook, and we've got a couple of copies to give away. Love to have you sign up for that. Whenever we have resources, we'd love to be able to give them away. We do a drawing at the end of the hour. You can call 877-933-2484. It's 877-933-2484. I assume that's Hawaii Five. Is that Hawaii Five?
Mission Impossible.
Mission
right?
Impossible, of course. Sure. Yes. Well,
kind of a detective mind.
Sure. We're going to find out from cold case homicide detective, who has served in law enforcement for a number of years. He also now is an adjunct professor of apologetics at Biola University. J. Warner Wallace has written a best-selling book called Cold Case Christianity and the new one, God's Crime Scene. We'll talk more with Jim Wallace in just a moment. Love to have you join the conversation as well. It's 877-93-FAITH.
You know this one here.
I do, yes. We're in the midst of, although I should say our inspector has much more ability, I think.
In speaking and in intellect.
Sure. J. Warner Wallace, a cold case homicide detective, has been in law enforcement for a number of years, and started out was a conscientious and vocal atheist, and described himself as an evidentialist, and he looked at truth tied directly to evidence. Well, as a guy got a hold of his life and changed him. And as about age 35, he started investigating that, wrote his first book, Cold Case Christianity. Came out in the late 90s, I think, or maybe I guess early 2000s, and it's been a bestseller. In fact, you can read his writings at his website, coldcasechristianity.com, and there he's been writing about the new book that he's just released called God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Detective Examines the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe. We do have some copies to give away. If you'd like to sign up for that, give us a phone call. Jim, there's always more than one way to explain evidence. So even as a detective, I'm sure, you know, if you got to the courtroom or even just among yourselves, there's always some explanations are more reasonable than others. How do we determine what's plausible?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people just really need to know that, need to hear that. I think we're sometimes, especially young Christians, are shocked when they get to university and they encounter, maybe for the first time, somebody who's got an alternative explanation for some of the stuff they've been taught God is responsible for. And then maybe nobody ever in their youth group or in their upbringing showed them what the alternative explanations were. And then they get for the first time in university and like, wow, just the fact that there is another way to explain it is shocking for some people. And I'm like, okay, well, every criminal case I've ever worked, we didn't spend 6 weeks in front of the jury, and then it's the turn for the defense team, and the defense team gets up and says, you know, that was so good, we don't have anything we can say, we're just going to rest. No, instead, they now give their six-week presentation with all the witnesses that they're going to call, trying to argue just the opposite that we claimed. And this happens even when after we win the case, the defendant confesses. I've had a case where the defense put up a huge defense a team and, you know, 3 weeks of defense just to have their guy confess to it after he was convicted. So it turns out that all of that apparently reasonable explanation that were offered by the defense team were not only not reasonable, they were false. And the defense eventually has to admit, yeah, our guy confessed to it. And they act like they're shocked, of course. I mean, maybe they are shocked. But the point I'm trying to make here is don't be surprised that the other side can present an adequate, seemingly reasonable alternative. People do this all the time. It doesn't mean that seemingly reasonable alternative is true. You've got to assess things in terms of their ability. How well do they explain the evidence we have? And are they over? Every time I see a defense offered in trial that is not really adequate, it fails for one of three reasons. Number one, it's just not supported by the evidence, okay? There's not enough evidence to support their position. Ours is better, reconciles the evidence. Number two, it makes some logical fallacy, some logical connection is missing. You know, why would he do it this way? I mean, they want us to believe he would, you know, and so there's a logical issue. And then three, sometimes they'll just try to redefine. They'll even want the jury to rethink about the law. They want to redefine the case altogether because that would kind of help their guy get off. Well, I think this is what happens when I see people try to explain these eight pieces of evidence that we've been talking about in the universe. From a naturalistic perspective, be careful. Look carefully. Are they accounting for all the evidence? Are they redefining the problem? This happens with consciousness, for example. People are constantly trying to explain consciousness, not by providing evidence to explain it, but by trying to redefine what it is to avoid the outcomes that we think are most reasonable. And finally, look for logical fallacies, logical, you know, missteps that don't make any sense. So those are the things I think we have to be aware of. But just remember, the one big takeaway, I think, for students especially, is don't be shaken just because the other side can offer an explanation. They always can. It doesn't mean that explanation is true. And that's also true for us, guys. I mean, just because we're offering an explanation doesn't mean that our explanation is true either. Both sides need to be weighed evidentially.
Well, as you said, you used conscience as an example, but maybe you want to expand on that a bit more, or maybe one of the others in terms of fine-tuning or life from non-life. But maybe take those three. I mean, not supported by evidence. There's something logically missing or redefining the case. Just expand. Maybe take one of those and divide it out a little bit more for us.
Sure. Consciousness is and free agency are huge. I think sometimes we always say that friends of mine always kind of laugh about this. One of the best arguments for God's existence is just the fact that you and I can argue. In other words, we think we have a conscious life. Is our conscious life just the activity of our brain, or do we really think we have an immaterial, non-material, conscious existence in which we can weigh ideas and make free choices between alternatives. This is part of the reasoning process. This is part of the arguing process, is to evaluate freely ideas and offers and decide which is more reasonable. Well, let's think about that for a second. If we're in an atheistic universe in which all we have is space, time, matter, and the laws of physics, well, that can explain how you might, you know, eventually through some process of evolution, let's just go with it for a second. What if somehow brains evolve? If even that could happen, which I don't think it can, but even if it could happen, could your brain be identical to your mind? In other words, atheism says you're in a physical universe, which is all entirely physical, and everything in that physical universe is determined by physics. Every event in that physical universe is therefore determined by a prior physical event, so that your thoughts are not really the free thoughts in your non-material mind. They are just the material consequence of prior physical events in your brain for which you have no control. You can't control the dominoes that are falling. Dominoes don't make choices. So you think you can make a choice. Really, you don't if all you are is a physical brain. You're just having prior physical events of neurons firing caused by prior physical events you can't control that lead you to this point. If that's the kind of universe we're in, then why would you think you have the ability to think freely? You don't. Everything you think is a free thought is actually an illusion. It's been caused by a prior necessitated physical event that occurred in your brain if atheism is true and if naturalism is all we have. And there are people out there who are now writing, even atheists, and I offer them in the book, who are challenging that is our naturalism somehow, are we missing it somehow? Because how can we trust our free thoughts if evolution and natural processes in the entire physical realm of the universe is all there is? It's time for us to reassess whether or not this kind of physical universe could give you minds. This is why this is called by philosophers the problem of mind. It's not a problem for you and I as an atheist, as a theist, as a Christian, but it is a problem for atheists who are physicalists who believe all we have is matter, space, time, and the laws of physics. The mind is a problem for those kinds of folks because you can't get it from the stuff of the universe. And so what I see people doing is saying, well, okay, let's just redefine what consciousness is. If we can redefine it in some way, and this is what I see all the time happening, well, then we can kind of, you know, find a way to explain it, because we're going to redefine it away from what we would typically experience into some other definition. I offer these in the book. Or maybe they'll say, well, if we can say it's just the same thing as the brain, that all mental entities are the same as the physical entities of the brain, but that has to ignore five pieces of evidence that I offer in the book. So here again, we see that you're making the same kinds of missteps I see in trials. Either it doesn't match the evidence, or you've tried to redefine something in order to explain it, but then of course it doesn't match our own common experience of consciousness. So these are the two steps I see people making, trying to stay inside the room to get this very difficult thing we experience, consciousness, but we don't know how to account for it.
Which probably, as long as we're sort of staying on that line, we could talk about moral truths, right? Because are they simply a product of individual belief? What does the evidence point to there?
Well, if we believe there are objective transcendent moral truths, now that's the first step. First of all, do we believe that? Do we believe there are objective – do we believe that some things are true for everyone at any point in history, even if there's a Star Trek universe in which there are other beings in the Federation of Planets, that these objective transcendent moral truths would span all the other alien life forms? You know, it's never okay to torture any of them for fun. Well, now we've got a moral truth that not only spans us as a culture, it spans the entire human species, and it even spans all the other alien species. It's an objective, transcendent moral truth that we cannot offer as just grounded in our own personal opinion, because, no, it spans persons. We can't argue that it's just grounded in our culture, because, no, it spans cultures. We can't argue it comes from our planet, because, no, we would say it even span planets. Well, where does such an objective, transcendent moral truth come from? Only if you've got something that is a objective, transcendent grounding for this moral truth. And remember, all moral obligations are between people. So if there's an objective transcendent source for this kind of truth, it has to be a personal source, because you are never obligated to the laws of physics. You're not obligated to physical objects. I'm, as a police officer, I'm not obligated to my police car. I'm obligated to my community, persons, and to my partner, a person. Moral obligations are between persons. If there are objective, transcendent moral obligations, who is the objective, transcendent moral person to whom we are obligated? That's the question, right? It seems to me that's a much better – we're looking for something to whom we feel this obligation, and it cannot be simply the laws of physics. It's something personal, someone personal that spans all of us.
Well, and the same comes up, too, when we talk about the problem of evil. I'm just curious to know, as you share just a little bit about your story, but wondering, you know, being a homicide detective, I'm sure you saw more than your fair share of the evil in the world that, you know, we've been subject to. So was that maybe a stumbling block for you or a motivator to say, you know, there's got to be more to this than my atheistic beliefs are allowing?
Okay, well, you know, I want to sound harsh with this, but I can tell you, for me, that was never. You just have a tendency that when you're doing this work, there are some things you turn on and turn off. Because if you didn't do that, you'd either go crazy, or you wouldn't be able to do the work. And so for me, I'll just tell you that I never really was disturbed by the level of evil and crazy evil that I was seeing on a daily basis. It was not the kind of thing that caused me to seek. And so I wasn't the kind of guy who was searching for a solution to the problem of evil. I wasn't searching for meaning in my life. I wasn't searching for some form of context or success or trying to solve a problem. Or I had a great life prior to looking at these evidences. I was pretty much on task. I've been with my wife now for 36 years. We were together for 18 prior to getting saved. And so for me, it all came down to walking into a church for the first time at the age of 35 and having the pastor just pitch Jesus in a way that I had never heard him pitch before. I wasn't a church guy, but I didn't think that anyone talked about him this way. And this pastor talked about Jesus as a smart guy. That's it. A smart guy. Really smart. The smartest man who ever lived. And you might want to listen to what this smart guy has to say. So I thought, well, I'm interested in smart guys. And I bought a Bible to read the smart words of Jesus. And as I read through those Gospels to get the smart words, I started to see things in the Gospels that bugged me, because they had the taste, the character that I see in other, I see the same thing in other accounts that are given by eyewitnesses of the same, in my own professional work. If I've got more than one eyewitness, there's certain characteristics of eyewitness statements. And as I'm reading the Gospels, I'm like, wow, these characteristics are here. I owe it to myself to go a little further. And so I took another step, and I started to investigate them under the principles I use to evaluate witnesses. I went another step, and I started to use forensic statement analysis, which I often use with my suspects. I started to use that on the Gospels, and I took another step, and I just continued to dig. And I finally got to the point, guys, where I was like, you know what? With the exception of the miracles, these, to me, measure up in terms of reliability. I reject miracles, though. I reject the supernatural. And that's when I said, it's time for me to look at why I think my philosophical naturalism can explain everything in the universe. Because if it turns out my philosophical naturalism can't explain everything in the universe, then maybe these accounts aren't just reliable up to a point. They're reliable all the way through. Because if there's a God who can bring everything into existence from nothing, Genesis 1, basically, that's the biggest and best miracle that we've ever seen recorded. It's not walking on water, rising from the dead. That's small potatoes for a God that can bring everything into existence from nothing, the entire known universe. So I really had to challenge myself and ask, you know, is my hesitation about anything supernatural warranted? Or do I have good reason to believe that the best explanation for everything we see in the universe is actually outside the universe? Well, now that everything changes. So I actually did both these books, and it took me about 6 weeks to walk through everything I talked about in Cold Case Christianity, and then begin a walk through everything I talk about in God's Crime Scene. And at the end of those two steps, I found myself saying, okay, you know, this is really, I really need to rethink my natural. I can remember exactly where I was. I can remember when, you know, where I was when I first started to the light bulb started going on for me. But it had, for me, I had to knock down all this stuff first. So I'm one of those guys, and there are lots of us out there who you might say, well, I don't think Christian apologetics or studying the science or the evidence really brings anybody to faith. Well, I'll tell you what it does. It clears the shrubs. It clears the obstacles. It knocks down the walls that we've erected around ourselves so that we can't even hear the gospel. And once those walls have been knocked down, then you can hear the gospel. And so I just needed to knock those down. And that's what I just tried to chronicle here in both Cold Case Christianity and in God's Crime Scene.
Talking with Jim Wallace, J. Warner Wallace has written a new book called God's Crime Scene. A cold case detective examines the evidence for a divinely created universe. He gives the evidence on the crime scene, if you will, to determine if they point to a divine intruder. If you've ever wondered if something or someone outside the natural realm created the universe and everything in it, this is the case for you. We've got some copies to give away, and we'll take more comments and questions. We're going to talk about, Richard Dawkins' claim that evolution can explain the illusion of design and planning. We'll respond to that and more in just a minute. 877-93-FAITH is our phone number, 877-933-2484. More with Cold Case Homicide Detective J. Warner Wallace coming up. Looking at God's Crime Scene, that's the title of a new book from J. Warner Wallace, who's written a best-selling book, Cold Case Christianity. This is a cold case detective examining the evidence for a divinely created universe. And as we've gone through some of these eight pieces of evidence that we have to honestly evaluate and look at, what does the evidence point toward? Richard Dawkins, of course, who's well-known atheist, says, well, the evolution can explain the illusion and design of planning. Say more about how we can counter that argument, which is so prevalent today.
I think this is a great point, because I think there's some things that we kind of stipulate to in trials. Stipulating basically is when both sides agree that this is not something we're going to contest. We both agree to this statement. Usually there are statements of fact that both sides will stipulate to. And we see this happening on this case with this issue about the appearance of design. Both sides, whether you're a theist or an atheist, we both see something in biological structures, the icon of which over the last, say, 15 or 20 years now has been the bacterial flagellum. It's this little rotary motor that's in bacteria. It has become, now we've just since then, look, there's just thousands and thousands of these small micro machines at the molecular level in all different kinds of cells, even in the human body. There are several of these processes that are little machine-like processes at the molecular level, and you find these, and remember, these things exist in biological structures. They are extremely sophisticated. They resemble the same kind of sophistication we see in other designed objects, other designed engines, rotary engines that we see in our own human experience. We actually were designing rotary engines for years before we discovered this one in 1978 at the molecular level in bacteria. The question is, if it looks designed, is there some way we can get the appearance of design without a designer? Is there as Dawkins would say, a blind watchman, some kind of blind set of forces that can produce what ends up looking like it's an intelligently designed set of forces? And that's the question. Can some process of evolution, and that's all you really have available to you if you're on the atheist side here and you're looking at biological structures, is how do these come into existence? Well, through some process of physics and evolutionary processes of natural selection and random mutation. This is all you have available to you. Now, so what I did in the books, I looked to this and I said, okay, first of all, why do we think something appears to be designed to begin with? And then when we know something, it turns out there are eight attributes that I've identified of design, that if you see five or six or seven or eight of these in any particular structure, you've got good reason to believe that this is not something that happened naturally. This is something, if you walked in the middle of a forest and you saw an outboard motor on a stand in the middle of the trail, you would not conclude that this thing sprang up in the woods naturally. You would reasonably infer that somebody left the motor in this natural environment. Why? Because it possesses the eight attributes of design I described in the book. I won't get into all that detail, but the point is, once you have a template, then you can say, well, if I see these eight attributes of design, I'd be a fool not to think there was an intelligent designer. But then you can apply the eight attribute template to other things. And I apply it, for example, in the book to a bird's nest. Why do we think a bird's nest is designed by birds rather than just evolved in the tree? Because it possesses these attributes. And I think once you apply that template, then you look at the biological structures and you're like, okay, great. I mean, there's no way that evolution, there's no pathway anyone has ever offered to, for example, explain the bacterial flagellum. Sometimes a smaller machine that's similar, called a type 3 secretion system, is offered. But I'm telling you, once you apply this template, you realize that even the type 3 secretion system is an irreducibly designed object, and you're not going to be able to get that through evolutionary processes. Neither one of these two things can you get to through evolutionary processes. And that was so powerful for me. But worse than that, guys, you know that all of these are guided by DNA information, and we have never seen a source for information other than intelligence. Intelligence is always where we get information from, yet we know that all of biology is driven and dictated by the intelligent information we have in DNA. Well, we can't get that information in DNA from physics. You can't get that information by random chance and natural causes. You've got to get that kind of information as best inferred to an intelligent source for information. So again, you have yet another thing pointing to intelligence. And the more you see the evidence pointing in that direction, why do we continue to resist it? You know, what is keeping us out when all the evidence we have is pointing in that direction? That's the problem, I think. And so for me, it really challenged me to rethink how I thought about the universe.
Well, we don't have time to talk about the lack of time to make evolution work, because I do want to give you a chance to respond to that. The opposition is so strong to the idea, the concept of a divine, intelligent design. You know, we've been studying it for generations, as you said. What's behind the opposition, the strong opposition?
Well, I think, don't forget, our worldview as theists, especially as Christian theists, doesn't come unattached. Remember that. We can offer better explanations for these eight pieces of evidence. But don't forget, it also comes along with it a God who has pronounced certain moral proclamations about how we ought to live, how we can pursue Him, how we can be saved by Him, what holiness looks like. And if you're somebody who's not really fond of those things, and you know they come along tied to this notion of the intelligent designer outside the universe, I can see why you might want to reject the designer altogether, because what you really don't like is not the idea of a designer. You don't like that this designer might actually have a plan for your life, might actually have some things that he frowns on and some things that he doesn't. This designer comes along with a set of other issues, and I think sometimes what we're resisting is not the designer, it's the other issues. So I think that's part of why we see this kind of resistance.
You, we've got just about 90 seconds left or so. I'm just thinking maybe there's somebody listening now who is skeptical, or maybe like you were, it's all materialistic, naturalistic. What would you say, where to start? And is it just a matter of using kind of the five W's, who, what, when, where, why?
Well, if you take those five, you know, the five questions we always ask, right, the what, how, when, where, the problem is don't forget to ask the who question, because if you stop short of the who question, you end up with more questions than you have answers. The answer, if you go all the way, for example, if you're looking at, say, the origin of life in the universe, you know, how did it happen? You know, what's the mechanism that was used? Where did it happen? When did it happen? All kinds of open questions, because you refuse to ask the bigger question, who could be responsible, because the who ends up solving all the other questions. So don't stop short of who questions. I think if you remember to ask the who question, you'll find yourself in a place of looking for that first cause that is going to have to be – look, all of us, atheists or otherwise, believe there's a cause outside the universe that caused the universe. The only difference is they believe it's an impersonal force. We believe it's a personal force called God. So don't forget to ask the who question.
You're writing regularly at coldcasechristianity.com, right?
That's right. And we're trying to do something every day that'll help take people another step. Yeah, I write books, and I'm happy to have people buy them, believe me. But what I'm really concerned about is, are we getting ready as Christians to defend what we believe? I think there's no time anymore for us to be accidental in our beliefs. We have to be intentional. And so what we're trying to do at Cold Case is to give you guys resources you can use to be more certain about what you believe.
Check it out, coldcasechristianity.com, and there you'll find the writings of Jim Wallace, J. Warren Wallace. He's a cold case homicide detective, and he has written a great book called Cold Case Christianity. And then the new one we've just been discussing today, God's Crime Scene, where we're examining the evidence for a divinely created universe. And this is published by David C. Cook, and I recommend it to you. It's a great resource for really from simple questions to lots of detail. It's footnoted. It's well worth your time to check it out. God's Crime Scene is the name of the book. If you missed part of today's program and you want to hear it again, we post the interviews on our website. And, of course, we always love it when you pass it on to friends, someone that might really appreciate hearing and getting into dialogue about it. You can go to myfaithradio.com and click on the Connecting Faith show page. That's myfaithradio.com.